You're listening to Face Off, episode 29, recorded August 2nd, 2009. Face Off. Welcome to Face Off, your face-to-face web technology podcast. I'm one of your hosts, Jade Robbins.
And I'm Mark Sanborn.
And in this podcast, we talk about various aspects of web technology, such as web development, social media, and web entrepreneurship. As always, you can view our show notes by going to faceoffshow.com. All right, Mark, we got some news and follow-ups, or just a piece of news this week. It's that a company actually received a patent for podcasting.
Interesting. Yeah, they've got not only podcasting, but episodic media in general through basically RSS and other means. They gave Hulu as an example that's using this type of...
So the company that got it was Volo Media, which apparently does podcasting analytics and advertising. But yeah, so they're claiming that they started filing it in 2003, although podcasts, I mean, have been around since early 2000. The discussion of it, I guess, was started in around 2001. So how did they get this? I think this just shows the sort of disconnect between the U.S. Patent Office and technology on the forefront, and that something needs to happen, because you should not receive a patent for something like this. It's not unique. It's not something that they developed explicitly. It was kind of a community effort talking about it. Adam Curry claims to be the first person who ever did a podcast, but it's just something that a lot of people are using, and they, you know, received a patent way late, and it's kind of silly.
Yeah, they're showing a lot of examples of where this type of technology was used in, you know, early 2000 and 2001. So I don't know. I have a feeling that if this ever went up to court or something that had a higher scrutiny of what it actually is, I don't think it would hold up. But it's interesting because they got it passed. It's official.
Yeah. And they're like, it's funny because this company is like, well, we're not going to target individual podcasters. And you're like, okay, but
they could if they wanted to. They could say, hey, you guys, you know, Face Off Show is a podcast and we own that patent. So
yeah,
you
exactly.
have to pay us royalties.
Yeah, exactly. Pay us royalties for the past, you know, 6 months you've been doing it. And yeah, I don't think this will hold up, but it's still frustrating. I think that's sort of the joke, is that it's funny that the patent office just seems to issue patents without really thinking about it anymore. You know, it used to make sense, but it seems now the technology is just much faster than the U.S. Patent Office can be, and so they just kind of look at these, what I would say, half-baked proposals and say, yeah, we'll patent that for you.
Well, it seems like to me that it's something that shouldn't ever be, you know, patented anyways. It's so general. I mean, it's like...
Yeah. Yeah, which is one of the things
a method of breathing or something.
Long, deep breaths are patented by me. So if you take a long, deep breath, you owe me 5 cents in royalties. So...
It just seems silly. But I don't know. It's interesting.
I don't know. We'll see what comes about that. But hopefully, people like you and I can stay on the air. If we... With our massive listenership, I'm sure hopefully we can stand the test of time of Volo Media and their lawyers. All right. So that's, you know, some interesting piece of news. Let's get into our web apps. What's the first one we have this week?
We have a cool one that uses, I believe, Flash, done by Hobnox, H-O-B-N-O-X, and it's called Audio Tool.
Yeah, it's really cool. Basically, what it does is it gives you almost like a whole beat studio on your computer on the web via Flash.
It's like a virtual, like you see your little pedals and knobs and you can change them. You've got the LED screens and it's like a virtual studio.
Yeah. So I mean, I've got, you know, here I've got like some awesome stuff. It's basically having like $20,000 worth of studio equipment on your computer
virtualized. Yeah.
Yeah.
And done in, I don't know, I guess Flash.
Yeah, so like here's like a rhythm composer and stuff. We took kind of like one of the default beats and kind of modified it a little bit. So here's the Face-Off beat done through the Hobnox audio tool. Yeah. That's groovy. Yeah. But you can, you know, you flick all the switches and you can add different parts to the beat. It's called like a tone matrix or something. You can just kind of like draw and fill in squares. And I mean, play around with it. It's got some really cool stuff. I'm really impressed with it.
You've got like if you need to plug another device in, you've got wires where you just kind of drag the wire to the other device.
Yeah. So like you you slide in a pedal, like a
an effects pedal,
any effects pedal, and so you can take like a device and you like hook it to the input on the effects pedal, and then you take the effects pedal and you put it out to like sort of your master control mixer and stuff like that. It's really cool, and it's doing what a lot of really expensive software does.
It's true.
You know, so I mean, if you wanted to, you could mix a beat on here and then just, you know, record it yourself, you know, using something like what is the Flower one, SoundFlower in Mac, mm-hmm. or something, and then put it in your, you know, any other software, and actually, you know, if you want to like rap to it and stuff like that. But it's pretty cool.
Do they not have a record? You can't record here?
You can't. I have a feeling maybe you have to pay for it. Like, yeah, okay, so you get 5 minutes of recording time by default.
Oh, okay.
So, I mean, if you wanted to, you could record like an
intro to
a 30-second, yeah, exactly, or a 30-second loop, and then if you wanted to like spit it out to your own software or not. But yeah, it's really cool. I mean, it's got a lot of advanced equipment that I would love to play around with that I cannot afford. I mean, I'm not going to start like releasing hip hop albums or anything, but you know, for a while I thought it'd be fun. I'm, you know, kind of a musical guy. It'd be fun to play around with something like this. And here I can without having to buy this or have, you know, cables running around throughout my office.
And this is done kind of like a social media, you know, music and art kind of, I'm not sure exactly what they do, but,
yeah,
they're like all about music and art and
yeah, exactly.
Creating sounds. So
here I'm going to crank up the delay. Ooh, yeah. You can make some really cool sounding stuff, and you can make some really terrible sounding stuff as well. They don't have like instruments yet. They have like a synthesizer if you want to play around with. I think it'd be cool. I think it'd be really cool to interface this with like a MIDI interface for your, you know, like if you have your own instruments, or, you know, like so you could put your guitar in and play around with the pedals on the guitar or something like that. But as it stands right now, it's a really cool app. It looks beautiful. I mean, it just kind of sitting on your desk, it looks like the real equipment. You know, it's got all knobs, like you said, so you actually, you know, turn the knobs to change the volume and stuff like that. It's got little VU meters and stuff. So it's really cool, really advanced. It's amazing that they made something like this as a web app.
Yeah. They also have some other cool projects too, where you can hook up a webcam and insert live streaming video and mash up stuff on the web.
No like way.
Like Adobe Final Cut or something, but web web-wise.
No way.
But this one's really cool.
Yeah. I like it. Pretty cool. It's the audio tool from Hobnox. Check it out. Like Mark said, they have other stuff too. This was kind of the one that we ended up playing around with, but check them out. They have some pretty neat stuff. The next app that we want to talk about is by Zenbee. I'm not really sure how to pronounce that. It's just
Zenbee. And it's called ShareFlow.
Yeah.
So ShareFlow is kind of like Google Wave, but it's out ready to go right now. There's no invites or signups or anything like that.
Yeah. So it, you know, you can go in, and when you go in, there's, you know, it's not a wave, but it essentially is. It's kind of like this long flowing conversation where you can do lots of stuff too. You can just post a comment. You can post like a map, and it'll link to it, a Google map. Or if you post a link, like let's say a YouTube video, it embeds it within the conversation. And then with each conversation piece, people can comment on that, and it kind of threads it down.
It automatically pulls in your Gravatar, so you can kind of tell who's talking easily. You can upload files. They have a service kind of like CC Betty, where you can email things to the Wave. So
yeah.
Integrates there. You can schedule events like a calendar, you know, send calendar files or with anything like that.
It's not quite, it doesn't have like the bot support and stuff that Google Wave does. You get 5 flows for free. And they get their nice little address. Like we have one, faceoff.zenbee.com, and that takes you to our ShareFlow. You can upload files. Like if you upload a picture, it shows the picture inside of it, and you can comment on it. It's basically Google Wave, but without the whole sort of bot. And it's not open source. And you, if you want more than like let's say 5 flows, you have to pay. But it's out now. You can use it right now, and it's pretty cool. the funny thing about this web app, what it did solidify for me is that I don't think Wave is going to be as revolutionary as everyone thinks it is, which I've kind of said during the beginning, but now that I have been able to play with a product very similar to it, I don't think Wave is going to be this giant tsunami of awesome that everyone thinks it's going to be.
Yeah, it's not exactly like Wave, but it's enough to give you an idea of what it's going to be. And I kind of agree with you. I'm not sure. Maybe
Wave has a lot of like API stuff that you can do outside of the Wave itself, which this doesn't. But at the same time, it's just the core product of it is this. I mean, this is, you can do the same core things with this that you can do with Wave. And I just, you know, I was like, oh, that's cool. That's useful. You know, let's say, you know, we could do like our share ideas and stuff before recording with this or something. Mm-hmm. But I just wasn't like, you know, jaw on the floor, drooling on the counter type stuff with it. So I don't know. I guess we'll see when Google Wave does come out. But, you know, as for now, I'm not super wowed. But we've got some cool videos and pictures and stuff on our little flow.
So that was ZenBee. You can get to that by going ZenBee.com/. Actually, just that front page will get you. You can click on share.
Yeah, flow down, they have some other products too. Let me look at these.
Well, they got the ZenBee Mail, which I'm assuming probably integrates with the SharePlow, and then also ZenBee Lists for tasks, which also sync to the iPhone and some cool stuff.
Yeah, some cool stuff. Which is funny, actually. So this thing has the ability to kind of do like CC Betty, like you were talking about. The funny thing is, so a little side note, I just saw that CC Betty got like $1.5 million of venture capital funding.
Wow.
So I'm assuming we'll see some pretty cool stuff coming out from them in the near future.
Yeah, we'll be definitely checking in on that. If we see any updates, we'll let you know on the news and follow-ups.
Yeah, for sure. Okay, so let's get to our last web app, which is, this is kind of a cool one. It's called Tag Cow, and you can get to it by going to tagcow.com. And what it does is it crowdsources tagging of your photos, which is funny because it doesn't really talk about the crowdsourcing. I mean, it does, but, you know, it kind of seems like if you watch the videos, they're like, it's a way to tag your photos with useful information so you can find your pictures easily.
In the video, they almost made it look like you upload your images and magically it like describes your images exactly what they were. And you're like, wow, that's some amazing computer technology there.
Exactly. When I first saw the video, I thought, well, this must be one of those companies that made a really cool technology that they're hoping to outsource to places like Flickr or Picasa. Because if it can, like, the guy uploaded a picture and it was like a picture of a two-story house and it, you know, like it said two-story house. And I was like, how do you make a computer program that does that? That's amazing. Right. And you were like, dude, I bet that they use something like Amazon Mechanical Turk and like have people do it, you know, because it costs like 2 cents per picture you tag. And then it turns out that you were exactly right.
They use Mechanical Turk.
They use Mechanical Turk. So there are people. So it's cool because it's really useful. It's easy to find your pictures. You upload them and then give it a couple minutes and all of a sudden they're tagged with useful information like baby, man, standing, smiling, you know, which is cool. But then also, people are looking at your pictures.
That's true.
You know, someone has to look at your picture and tag it for you. So, grain of salt.
Yeah. They don't know whose picture it is. And they're probably not going to be saving it because they're sitting there making money and just on to the next job. But that is true. You are, your pictures are out there.
Yeah. So, but it is cool. It's a really useful service. I mean, especially if you have a lot of family photos, you can, you know, get them tagged so that you can find them. Some desktop applications do this already, like Picasa you can tag. I know iPhoto, it does like sort of face detection, and you can like tag it with people's name, but that's only native to that app.
Now, here's something that I didn't notice originally, but you can actually do third-party APIs. So you already have your pictures on Flickr, you just tell it, you'll give it a little access and it'll go and tag those.
That's cool. So then you don't have to just, well, does it tag it in Flickr?
It might import them and tag them. It could probably go both ways, though.
Because if they're Flickr, using an API, they could use the API to tag them, which that would be cool because then you wouldn't have to have them all on TagCow. You could.
Yeah.
So it is a tagging service. It's not a computer program that's doing it. It's people looking at it and tagging it, which there are just some things like that is a really hard computer problem. Mm-hmm. You know, that's why you and I were absolutely floored when we first saw it and didn't know that it was people doing it because we were like, wow. Like, facial recognition is hard enough, let alone being able to tell that it was a snowy day with a two-story house. You know, exactly. We were amazed. But
I was like, how do they know that?
Like, that's a cool program. But it is. It's crowdsourced, but it's cool. So, if you have a lot of pictures and you want to get them tagged with useful information, like, you know, if you want to see every picture that you have with a baby on it, well, there's a tag that you could search for if you use something like TagCow.
Yeah, so like if you had 2,000 pictures, was it 2 cents?
Yeah, 2 cents per picture.
So it'd be like $40, and mm-hmm. you get all your tags. And
exactly.
So you'd be able to search through like, you know, all your pictures. That's useful.
Pretty useful. If you have like 2,000, that's a lot of pictures. And especially, you know, like the one thing they talk about is if you're scrapbooking, you know, a lot and you just need that one picture that you know of in your head, but you can't find it. You don't remember which folder it's in. You don't, you know, you can search your tags for it and find it, which is useful.
And now in the trial version, you do get like, what, $5 worth of credit?
Yeah. So if you just sign up, you'll get a $5 credit to do your tagging. They have three types of tagging. There's, what is it, like descriptive tagging and then people tagging. Let me find that.
So that's 250 pictures. That's quite a bit to test it out.
Exactly. So people tagging is ideal for assigning a prescribed set of tags for photos containing a specific person you know. So you could do descriptive tagging like we talked about, which is two-story house, snowy day, beach, mountain. That's fine. Or you can do people tagging where they'll go and like tag each person as the same tag. Predefine who it is who at the beginning, but like they go through, and so like if you wanted to tag it with each person in your family, oh, here is Mark Sanborn, and then they'll see another picture with Mark Sanborn and tag that person Mark Sanborn. So it has two kinds of tagging. I think there was a third one, content filtering, but you know, that's, again, if you have a lot of pictures, this is a great service. It's pretty cheap. It's done through Mechanical Turk, which is cool because I don't know. Have we talked about that on the show?
No.
Amazon Mechanical Turk is a thing that Amazon set up as a way to make money and to get little jobs done. So if you're a person on the internet and you're bored and you just want some money, they're really simple jobs that computers can't do very well.
Like taking images.
Yeah, exactly. Like, can you, like, looking at an album cover, like a scan of an album cover and telling you what the band name is, that's right. Hard for a computer. It can try and do OCR, but, you know, album covers are goofy, you know, and it can't tell the difference between the artist and the album. So Mechanical Turk is great for that because a human looks at it and they say, okay, that's, you know, Smokey Joe's Big Blue album, you know?
In episode 16, we talked about Mechanical Turk a little bit.
Okay.
About a half hour in, so if you want to check that out.
But it's a great way to make money, or if you have jobs, like a bunch of, again, really simple jobs that are hard for a computer to do, you can set it up on Mechanical Turk and actually pay people to do it.
Yeah, I remember doing one a while back where they asked, is this picture centered on the business front of the shop? Is there, because they were driving down the road with a van or something taking images, and they wanted to map geo address locations to a front end image so you could see what the business looks like before you go there.
Okay.
So stuff like that, like where a computer would have no idea.
Yeah, it just can't tell. It would be way too much work to get a computer program to do that.
I'm looking here. It does actually push your images and tags back up to Flickr. So
awesome.
There's a good example.
That's really cool. So check it out. It's TagCow. It's a cool service. I just think this is great because it's pretty innovative. It's a clever business idea that I never would have thought of, that I like to see, because I would have thought, okay, how can we get computers to do this for us? But the person they just went around it and said, well, no, instead of spending all this money to get a computer to do it, let's just pay people a little bit of money to do it, and then people can have their pictures easily searched and indexed.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
TagCow.com. All right, so let's get into our first topic. Oh, I just want to mention that if you have any news or follow-ups or a web app that you want us to look at, go to faceoffshow.com/feedback and let us know any way possible, and we'll check it out. It might even be on the show. If you leave like a voicemail in our Google Voice number, we might even play you on the show. So let us know.
Which, by the way, is 31 Web 2 Tech.
Web, the number 2, and Tech. I like it.
All right, so what is it? Our first topic.
Yep, is 10 lessons from a failed startup, which is a VentureBeat article. Was that Entrepreneur Magazine?
Entrepreneur. Yeah, VentureBeat. You got it
VentureBeat.
Right.
VentureBeat. Okay. So, a lot of new businesses fail pretty quickly.
I would throw the statistics out, but
yeah, exactly. It's again, it's fake.
It's definitely more than half.
It's between, yeah, it's like, I'm pretty sure within the first 2 years, it's between 80 and 95. It's one of those numbers. Between, that's quite a difference, but still, basically, mm-hmm. a lot of businesses fail in the first 2 years. So, and like serial entrepreneurs, they kind of almost expect to have a couple failures. You just know that, you know, you hedge your bets and sometimes things just fail.
Mm-hmm.
So this article is from a guy who had a startup that failed.
And so these are the lessons.
Yeah, so he gave us some quick lessons so that hopefully if you're starting a new business within the first 2 years, you can actually look at these lessons and not have to learn them the hard way like he did.
So we're going to talk about them.
All right, so the first one is find quick money first. And the gist behind this is, don't keep mulling around forever waiting for that perfect angel investor that's going to give you all the money, you know.
In one shot.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Try and get some money and get things rolling, at least. Because if, you know, you just keep spending all your time looking for the perfect investor, you might never find that, and then someone else will do your idea, and then you'll, you know.
His example is to find maybe like 10 smaller investors to get you going, and then once you have traction, the bigger guys will find you anyways.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So if they're good investors, they should have their, you know, so their hand on the pulse and know when you're getting big enough that they should come and invest in you anyways. Number two is content businesses suck. And the sort of subtitle is, or do it for love and expect to lose money. I've actually seen a lot more articles and stuff lately about how content businesses are not the way to go. And I think it's because we're so used to free content that paying for content is a very difficult business model to get going. And usually you
almost
can't
always ad revenue based.
Yeah, which then just leaves you small margins. You're basically, if you're doing an ad revenue business, purely ad revenue, you're getting, if you do something like AdSense, you're just getting whatever Google will give you out of the money it's making from selling your ads.
Content creation is difficult. At times it can be frustrating. You could have a streak where you're not producing very high quality content. Mm-hmm. You know, things like that can happen.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, in all honesty, you and I have kind of been going through a struggle lately. We've been doing a lot of recording really quickly. Usually we have a really structured sort of way of doing it. And our schedules have kind of been conflicting in the past 2 to 3 weeks. So we've kind of been rushing it. And it's hard to find content, especially when you're under the gun. Right. Now, if you just really love it and it flows naturally, then it's okay. But, you know, when, you know, you and I are really dedicated to making sure we have a podcast out every week. So when it comes crunch time and it's like, okay, we have to record a show because we can't do it next weekend, it, you know, sometimes our content suffers because of it.
Mm-hmm.
Number three is know when to value speed versus stability. And so there's a really good example for this.
The main example is like eBay is going to be moving and evolving at a very slow rate as businesses and people depend on it. It can't go down. It can't be down even for a minute, you know, mm-hmm. Where Twitter is, well, they've had a lot of, they want to evolve fast. They want to do the new technology. And if they've got some hiccups and problems, it's not the end of the world. It's mm-hmm. just a microblogging service. Yeah.
But when people's money
is involved,
is literally depending, like eBay, there's a lot of yeah. businesses who are doing all their business solely on eBay.
Right.
They can get a lot of customer rumblings when they have an outage or a feature that doesn't work as expected.
Yeah, if you're doing something that's mission critical, like a shopping cart system or shipping system, it has to work. Yeah. And if you're migrating to a new technology, you need to tell people like 4 months in advance and remind them every month. Yeah. And like, you know,
yeah, exactly. So like
be very stable.
So now it's a good point because if Twitter, I mean, does go out of business, there's a lot of businesses that have all their businesses solely riding on Twitter because they offer features involving Twitter. So Twitter is starting to shift more towards that mission critical. If outages happen, it's a bad deal sort of system.
Yeah, and I think this one is all about, you know, you got to know when the best one fits your, you know, because if Twitter didn't evolve, maybe somebody else might have taken over in that space. Whereas, you know, eBay doesn't need to evolve very fast because they're
king.
They're king. I mean, they're stable. You know, and it's a so.
Yeah, I agree. Number four is set a dollar value on your time. And I agree with this 100%. A lot of new entrepreneurs or business people, they won't pay themselves for the longest time, or they don't really know how much their time is worth. But if you sit and think about it, then you say, okay, this business is getting this much of my time, which is worth this much, and I'm not getting this out of it in the end. So I need to figure something out or decide to knowingly take a big personal loss.
Yeah, and also tasks that you do inside your business. He gave an example here in his article that he had called a cell phone company and was trying to, you know, negotiate his bill down and get his rates down. And he found himself spending 3 hours negotiating his bill down, only $100. And he felt that that wasn't a good use of his time because, mm-hmm. you know, his time's worth more than that.
Yeah, exactly. Same thing. When you start a business, and we talked about this before, when you build your business plan, you need to sort of think of all the positions that you want inside your company. So it comes to the point of, if you're doing all this positions work that you could get by hiring an employee at a much lower rate, then it's time to, because your business is losing money by wasting your very expensive time. Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
At the very beginning, maybe you can be very resourceful and try to negotiate prices down and stuff because your time is not as valuable. But once you start getting up there and start really concentrating on your business, and you know, you got to start finding people to do that for you.
Yeah, or if your startup, I mean, let's say your startup can only afford to pay you $12 an hour, and you could go into the private sector and start get $50 or $60. Maybe you should think about it. Do you really want to own your own business, or are you ready to take this financial hit for that long when you could go into the private sector and, you know, live really frugally and make some good money and then have basically your own startup capital? I don't know, something to think about. But valuing your own time is important, and looking at what you're doing with that is also very important.
So the next one is, marketing requires constant expertise. He's a very strong believer that, you know, marketing is not something that's just anybody can do. He was saying that marketing, you should hire the people that are very good at it, you know, the experts at marketing. As soon as you can, find somebody that can do the marketing, because it's not, in his opinion, is not very easy to do.
Yeah, it's hard. And he made a really good point here. He said marketing, as the market gets really saturated, marketing is that much more important, making yourself stand out. We talked about earlier, two episodes ago, or two or three, the five P's of marketing. And so there are certain parts of it, that, like your product maybe needs to stand out. Or if your product doesn't stand out, maybe you need to look at promotion more, you know, or, you know, distribution.
Yeah. Sometimes you have a viral idea, but they're very few and far between.
Yeah. And when you try and make it viral, it never works. It usually flops in your face. So number six is, control and calculate your user acquisition costs. This is a really good metric to think about, just thinking about your business in general. What does it take to get a new customer? How much advertising do you have to use to get a new customer? And how expensive is it if they leave? So you need to decide if it's well worth it to just try and get a bunch of new customers. Like Twitter is a great example. They, you know, had this huge boom 6 months ago or whatever, where they had record signups. And then we found out that only, you know, 60% of those new signups were abandoned, and, you know, like another 20% posted once a month. You know, and so, you know, if you go through a big user acquisition like that, and acquiring new users is really expensive, which it really isn't for Twitter. Mm-hmm. But if you have a business where acquiring users are expensive, then you need to work on keeping those that are there and not really push it trying to get new people. You know, is it cheaper to keep your existing customers or to get new ones?
Yeah, and you really need to know the actual dollar amount. Does it cost you $20 per user to gain them, or is it less than that? You need to use analytics and whatever you can to figure that out. If you're hiring a camera crew to come in and you know, shoot some kind of a demo or something like that, there's a cost involved with that. And then, you know, putting that on the internet, mm-hmm. how many people are being then converted from that demo, and is it worth it?
Exactly. Is it worth it? And what does it cost to get those new people?
He talks about A and B split testing. So is this one better than this one? This one might be a little bit cheap. It might convert more and then lower the acquisition cost.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So if you can get cheaper promotion that gets you more users, but let's say you, to keep existing users, it costs a lot more money to develop new products. And I'm like, okay, maybe you need to just get more new people and just pile it up. And if people leave, that's okay.
His one of his mistakes he found out is he spent $5,000 on some TV and radio spots, and it almost produced no new users, and it was almost a total waste of money. But where he spent on a different medium, he was, you know, it was much better.
Mm-hmm. And you can use like the Google, what was it, the Google AdWords tool or whatever to see what it would cost, you know, to get sort of an AdWord in that realm. And so then you can say, okay, well, if I'm pretty sure Google AdWords will get me more users that will use this, but if it's, you know, a $50,000 AdWord, then maybe you should just go with the radio TV ad. But if you can spend $5,000 on a Google AdWord and get twice the conversion, then you should do that.
Right.
Number seven is form partner relationships early, even if they're informal. And I think this is a great idea. It's sort, you know, networking, barter services. You know, if you can help another guy out without really, you know, costing a whole lot of money and just do it for free, and you know, and then you never know, they might go out and be an advocate for you or let you know when they see an opportunity come their way. All kinds of things.
Yeah, even if it's not like an official partnership, talking with them, somebody in the same industry, you might strike a deal later on because they know about you and they already have some sort of a relationship with you. So starting it early is best.
Yeah, like one really good example here in this article, as he talks about, is you know, partners will let you know of potential competitors, and that's something you wouldn't think about. But like, hey, keep your eye on these guys. They just, you know, I just noticed that they're looking for venture capital. They're kind of doing what you're doing, so keep your eye on them. Maybe, you know, you might have to try and see what they're doing.
That's a very good point.
Number eight is plan cost conservatively and err on the side of raising too much.
Yeah, I think this is kind of like where programmers underestimate their time it takes to do a project. I think business people tend to underestimate the cost involved in doing something.
Yeah. Yeah, you think everything's going to work smoothly and it's going to go just the way you expect and stuff, and things happen, so make sure you have a buffer in there. I mean, don't go crazy and be like, I need a $2 million buffer for my business. You know, look at what could possibly go wrong and what you might need to cover your butt on.
Yeah, find somewhere in the middle of the best case scenario and the worst case scenario.
Mm-hmm.
I noticed some people tend to do either the best or the worst. And try to, like, it's only going to cost this much, and then they find out later it was a way more, or maybe they're way too conservative and it's like way less. Somewhere in the middle is probably your best bet.
Yeah. Number nine is the key to negotiating is having options. And this is a great piece of advice, because if you don't have any options, you're against the wall. You have nowhere else to go. You know, if you're saying to yourself, I need to make this deal or I'm sunk, then that's bad. Mm-hmm. You need to have more options.
Yeah, the book that I was reading, Getting to Yes, Negotiating Without Giving In, kind of talks a little bit about this. If you don't have options, it's evident to the person that you're doing the deal with, and they know they can get you for all you're worth.
Yeah, I mean, one of the best negotiating tactics is if you have tried to make a good deal and they still say no, then you can say, okay, I'm walking.
Yeah.
That's fine. You know, my friend just went to China and was, you know, going to street vendors and stuff in the street. And he said it was really hilarious because you would walk up and you just basically be like, I'll give you, there's never a price on anything at all. And it was pure negotiating. So you'd walk up and be like, I'll give you a dollar for that. And it was like, oh no, that's worth way more than a dollar. And you'd be like, okay, $2. And they'd be like, oh no, it's worth way more than $2. And he would say, okay, and walk away. And then the second you turn your back, they'd be like, okay, $3, you know?
$2.50, you know?
Yeah, exactly. And he'd come back and be like, okay, two. And then he said that if you didn't understand that culture, you would go over there and just get soaked because you would pay way too much than you ever had to.
Yeah, Mexico is very similar to that.
Yeah, too. You just give them a ridiculous lowball. But, you know, again, that's your options. You have the option definitely not to buy a trinket or something from a from a vendor on the street. So you have that option to say no and walk away, and they know that, and that's when they really start to really deal with you.
Yeah, and also you could put your options on the table. Say, hey, if we don't do this, I'm going to end up having to go over here and. So let's negotiate. Come on.
Yeah, exactly.
Gives you some options.
The last one is knowing isn't enough. And this is this is true because I have a really big problem with this. I know, but I don't act, and you really need to act, and you really need to be proactive. I mean, all the time we say this, I was like, you know, I think a really cool web app would be something like this. And then, you know, 2 months later, I see that someone just got venture capital for basically the same idea. I knew, but I didn't do.
Right. He gives an example that if he were given this, you know, 10 things back a few years ago, he would have said, oh, yeah, I know that stuff, and then not followed his own advice. Yeah. It's kind of like, yeah, you should do a business plan if you're going to start a business. I know I should do
it. I know I should.
I'm just going to keep going and do it.
Yeah. So, again, it's just another thing. When going into business, it's scary. I mean, you know, it's funny. I'm on the same sort of precipice. I'm kind of like, all right, maybe I should incorporate and really start, you know, cranking out my own ideas. But I know, but I'm, you know, scared. So use these as some tips to try and not be one of those, that high percentage that fails within the first 2 years. But also know that failing might happen. And if you do it right, it's not that tragic. You know, you should be able to look at it and realize that was maybe not the best, you know, it was not the way to go. There was mistakes made, and learn from those lessons, and don't let it devastate you. Don't get all depressed and stuff because it failed. You know, try and buffer yourself ahead of time and plan it out right.
Yeah. Out of 10 projects, you might fail 5, have three or four winners and maybe one home run.
Yeah.
You know, you're not going to hit it out of the park every single project you do.
Yeah, and if you talk to any entrepreneur that does it a lot, they're going to say, you know, I've had failures, of course, because those failures, that's how you learn how to do it, and you need to.
All right, so that about wraps that segment up.
Yeah, so the next topic that we want to talk about is just kind of a generic topic of hosting options. So let's say, you know, there's all kinds of hosting options with features and stuff out there. And it can be kind of confusing because you don't really...
Web hosting, by the
way. Yeah, web hosting. Yeah. And so, you know, like to people like me and you, we've been doing it for a long time. It seems really clear, but some people might not know some of the options out there and where to go.
Or where to start, you know.
Yeah. Like,
depending on the project size, you might start
one place
or another. So... go ahead.
The first one that we kind of, it kind of goes in sort of like levels from like basic up to, you know, advanced. It scales, obviously. I mean, web hosting scales. So do web apps. So you need hosting that scales. The first sort of really basic level we have is like a hosted service. This is like an example, like Blogger or WordPress.com, or there's all kinds of like wiki hosting options out there.
Like wiki. Yeah.
Yeah.
Or project hosting. Project hosting, wiki hosting.
And so this sort of is like a great example is WordPress.com. You are getting a copy of the WordPress blogging system, which you could host your own, but it's this service, this product that's hosted on WordPress.com.
Yep. Usually a set queue of how much bandwidth you have and how much space you have.
Yeah, how much features, things like that. What you need to look for with this is like, what is actually being hosted? Is it a free open source product like WordPress, or is it a product that's closed source like Blogger? We don't know what's powering Blogger, but it's just a blog hosting service.
Right.
And do they cost money? What is the disadvantage of, you know, a lot of them are free. What is the disadvantage of free? Is there ads? Do you not really own your content? If I pay a small $5 fee a month, do I get basically the freedom of getting my own host and hosting my own copy of WordPress? I don't know.
Do you do the subdomain, or do you buy a domain and then point it to the free service? Like you said, do they have like Blogger, do they have like a logo at the bottom or top or somewhere?
Iframe at the top. Yeah.
You know, what's the disadvantage? There's obviously going to be a disadvantage of some sort if they're offering it for free.
Yeah. And there's all kinds of them out there. There's, you know, I mean, basically any sort of software as a service we talk is this. You know, I can get a project tracker. I can get a project tracker at Basecamp, but this, you know, it's software that I can't see behind it. It's proprietary software that they wrote themselves that is closed source. But at the same time, I could maybe get, you know, I could get a project tracker one with a popular project tracking software somewhere else. But look at it. There's lots of caveats to things like that. The next sort of level, and actually the hosted services in this one are pretty similar, is the WYSIWYG.
What sort you of. See is what you get.
Yeah, yeah. So WYSIWYGs have been around for a while. They started as sort of desktop applications that you would use to build a website and then upload it to a regular host. But now there's all kinds of web-based WYSIWYGs out there. Things like Google Sites or Squarespace is a popular one that's coming up. You can design your website without any technical knowledge. You go on and it's almost like a word processor. You're like, oh, I'm going to put a box here and I'm going to put a picture here and, you know, okay,
kind
save.
Of drag and drop and type like WordPress. Yeah, okay.
Yeah, you're not writing HTML. You're not writing any code. It's just what you see is what you get. So the whole point of a good WYSIWYG is when you design the website in the WYSIWYG and hit save and go to that website in a browser, it looks the same.
Right.
Traditionally, in the past, this has been sort of like static web pages, like here's about me, here's just a static page. But there's been some really cool things that's been happening with WYSIWYG editors, like Squarespace is doing some really cool stuff.
What are some of the things that they do over like Google Sites or one of those?
They have like all these kind of cool widgets that you put in your WYSIWYG stuff. Like you can start a blog with it, but it's like a WYSIWYG blog, and so within your page you can kind of put where you want the blog to be, and then if you want you can put like an RSS syndication widget. They have like guest books and stuff, but it's not like so
it's not like just a static page. You can actually have elements, dynamic elements,
like a dynamic full website using their WYSIWYG.
And it's drag and drop and easy to use.
Yeah, it's drag and drop. It's really easy to use. It looks great. It's really fancy. There's been some Squarespace has actually been kind of doing a lot of media stuff with like the guys from Revision 3. Mm-hmm. And so they've redone a lot of their websites using Squarespace, and
they look great.
They look great. They're pretty advanced. I mean, they can do some cool stuff with it without having to know any programming knowledge. They don't have to go in and set up WordPress or set up, you know, some guest book software. They just say, I want this page to be a guest book, drag and drop. Boop. Oh, there's your guest book. I want users to be able to download files. Okay, this page, you know, file Dropbox widget. Bloop, there you go. Now people can download your files. Oh, I want people to upload files to me. Bloop, there's an upload widget. It's pretty cool.
I've heard from some people that one of the side effects of Squarespace is that they end up being able to change their content all the time. So their page is always evolving and dynamic because it's so easy to use.
Yeah. Yeah, and so it's not, you're not stuck with sort of the same theme or anything like that. You can just kind of change it all the time and not
add a widget,
not in the way of like a blog where you post a new thing all the time. Like you can really make the whole website very dynamic.
Whereas if you're doing the coding yourself, you might have to go back to Photoshop, do a template, change the code. It's not
exactly. Yeah. There's a time cost associated with all that, and Squarespace gets rid of it for you. So some of the things that you want to look for with like a WYSIWYG is, you know, how easy to use is the interface? What features do I have? Is it going to be basically dynamic stuff or static stuff? Like I go in and I type it like a Word document and then publish it and it stays the same? Or is it like Squarespace where I can go in and add all kinds of cool widgets and still do pretty dynamic stuff? How much does it cost?
Is it going to be something that's going to be able to do everything you want?
Yeah.
You know,
yeah, and also know that with a WYSIWYG, it's usually you don't import out of the WYSIWYG. It's there forever. You can't really. It's not mobile between all different things.
Although Squarespace actually has, you can output your or export your template to like a WordPress theme or whatever.
Oh wow, actually, really?
They can import it and export it back out to WordPress.
No way. That's cool. They're doing some cool stuff at Squarespace. Pretty exciting. So check it out. You know,
I guess what are some of the disadvantages of WYSIWYG?
You're not doing it yourself. You're limited to what the WYSIWYG will let you do.
Okay.
You know, with other options, I can program, you know, in PHP and do whatever I want. But with a WYSIWYG, it's what options they have. Now, if you're lucky with something like Squarespace, they have a lot of stuff you could do. Google Sites is pretty cool too. I mean, I'm not trying to knock Google Sites, but I just checked out Squarespace for the first time and I was kind of excited about it. It's pretty cool. But it's, you know, you can't do whatever you want. You're limited to whatever the WYSIWYG lets you do.
Right. So if you're planning on doing something really custom, it's probably not going to be the the best. But if you're gonna, if you're looking to update all the time, and something that you can just do on the road yourself, and you're not really a, you know, a programmer or something, WYSIWYG is definitely the way to go. It's much faster.
Exactly. Yeah, and that's really what it's geared at. These, as you get more advanced, it's basically the advancement of the user who is doing it. You know, a hosted service, it's bare bones. It's basically, I have WordPress. I have WordPress's limitations. I have Blogger's limitations, but I can still blog. It's a service I can blog. Same with the WYSIWYG. I have, you know, I can make my, but it's a little bit more advanced. I can make my website. I can customize it how I want. It's not just a WordPress install. It's a website that can do little things. The next sort of level is called shared hosting. And it, again, requires a little bit more advanced knowledge. Okay. So like, shared hosting are things like DreamHost or GoDaddy hosting. Like, we use DreamHost.
So with this, you're starting to do the coding yourself now. Exactly. You're starting to get away from the kind of WYSIWYG or like blogger.com where it's kind of laid out and you just type into it. This is more, you're actually making the site, right?
Yeah, exactly. So basically they give you a space to do things, a file space almost, and a processing space, and you do what you want with that. So, you know, with shared hosting, I go in and I install WordPress. I go in and I install MediaWiki. I go in and program my own application, and it does the work after I've programmed it, but I have to go do it. Or even if you don't want to do programming, I create the static pages in HTML and upload them to their server.
Okay, so this is going to be more for someone that knows how to program, that knows HTML, CSS, those kind of mm-hmm. things, and really wants to do something custom, or they just want to have complete control over WordPress or the software that's installed.
Yeah, exactly.
So what are some of the things to look for on these?
Well, you want to look for what operating system is it? Is it Linux? Is it Windows? Do they not tell you?
Why should I care if it's Linux or Windows?
So it usually depends upon what programming languages you want to use. If you want to use PHP, you usually go Linux. There are some ways to do it in Windows, but if you want to do ASP, ASP.NET, you're going to need IIS, which is on Windows.
So, for example, WordPress is done in PHP, so you probably would want to find a Linux-based server.
Exactly.
If you were primarily going to do WordPress stuff.
Exactly. You know, PHP and a database.
Even though PHP can be ran on IIS, it makes everything just way more simple because PHP was actually made for Linux.
Yeah, exactly.
As far as like mod rewrites and things like that, it's just, yeah.
It's easier. I agree, definitely. Then some other things is, so what features do they add? We use DreamHost, and so they have kind of an account management panel, and they do little things like I can do one-click installs of software. If I don't want to, I don't have to manually install WordPress on DreamHost. I can go in and do a one-click install and say that I want this domain to have mm-hmm. WordPress, and it does it for you. I don't have to do all the file transferring and configuration and all that junk.
Yeah, I would say there's a programmer friendly shared hosting, and then there's just kind of like the here it is, and you can upload files through here kind of mm-hmm. deal. Would you agree with kind of like the GoDaddy versus? Like, I know DreamHost has like SSH access where mm-hmm. Maybe one person would say, I don't need that at all.
Yeah.
Versus a programmer would say, I would definitely kind of need that.
Yeah, there's different levels to it. I don't think the levels are quite as starkly different as the other levels. But yeah, like, you know, some websites, they're like 24/7 FTP access. And any of us that really do programming, we're like, I don't want to do FTP. I want to use SSH mm-hmm. and SCP or, you know, some.
Are you going to do Subversion or something?
Mm-hmm. A lot of them have, they kind of go both ways. So even, you know, DreamHost has a file manager built into their control panel. So you don't have to use FTP. You don't have to use SSH if you don't want. A basic user could get around it and even edit files there. I don't think they have a WYSIWYG, but you can go in and edit files. Usually they have both. I think they tend to default more toward programmer heavy. And then if they want to add other stuff, that's fine. Because there is sort of this trend of people who don't really want to do a hosted service, don't really want to do a WYSIWYG, but they still want like a presence on the web. And so this is kind of the option that they're choosing. And it has a lot more stuff than they need, but they still want to use like the web panel to go in and edit files and stuff like that.
Okay. So what are the disadvantages of shared hosting?
You're literally sharing a host with other people. You have a bunch of users on one server. You're kind of given your little slice, you know, there's multiple domains coming to one server. And if a lot of people are using or doing stuff, it can slow down. You're sharing a host with other people.
Okay. So it's kind of like, so one computer might host 20 or 30 different websites.
Exactly.
And yours is dependent on, if one of those other websites gets a lot of traffic, mm-hmm. your site kind of starts going slow.
Yeah.
Now the advantage is you're sharing the cost of that server
exactly.
with 20 other people. So
yeah.
It's cheap.
Yeah. And with shared hosts, they traditionally don't look at things like CPU usage and things like that. It's pretty much just, here is your space and here is your transfer per month. You know, you have 10 gigs of space, you have 10 gigs uh-huh. of transfer per month. If you go over that, you're gonna have to pay more. Another disadvantage is that, being you are sharing that host with other people, if they have web applications with vulnerabilities or problems, if it's not configured properly, that person can, if they screw up and someone hacks it and can get root access to the server, they've got root access to 20 other websites.
Another disadvantage that I just thought of is you are also sharing the applications on the server. So typically, now sometimes you can compile custom versions, but typically you share the same PHP version and that's all you get. You get one version and they're not upgrading until everyone upgrades at the same
exactly.
time.
You yeah, know? You don't have control over things like your software versions. You
can't reboot the server. Because
yeah, exactly. I can SSH into the server, but I can't install gems. I can't apt-get stuff. Basically, SSH is a interface to go in and edit your program.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, exactly. So they need to sort of do the midline, what's best for all the users on the server. So if you want bleeding edge stuff, they probably won't do it for you because it may be unstable and they don't want to compromise everyone else on the
definitely.
Server.
They don't want the server rebooting just for you when 19 other websites are already still running fine.
Yeah, exactly.
So going to the next step after this, if I want to do all that custom stuff, what would be my next step?
The next step is what's called a virtual private server. And the way this works is it's very similar to the sort of shared hosting, except for you're, instead of sharing, you know, one server that just serves out multiple web pages, you're getting an actual share of that computer as a small virtual computer.
So you've got guaranteed resources. This is your little slice or mm-hmm. little section of this server.
Yeah.
You're still sharing the entire server, but it's like, this is your little piece of it.
Mm-hmm. So like we were saying earlier, if you wanted to install a different version of PHP, that's fine. And it's also sandboxed. So if someone compromises your computer, mm-hmm. it doesn't compromise everyone else. Now it may jack up the CPU on the other server, but if they set it up correctly, it shouldn't.
As long as the physical machine does not, or as far as the virtual machine software goes, if that gets compromised, then you could have an off balancing. But
yeah.
for the most part, yeah, you're sandboxed.
So the
well.
way virtualization works is that you run multiple virtual, you know, pretend computers on one big computer, and they share the resources. Because if you think about it, a computer hardly ever, unless you're doing like hardcore research or rendering or anything like that, a computer doesn't use 100% of all of its resources all the time.
Right.
You tend to just need spikes or little bits. So a virtual server is you put a bunch of small virtual computers on one big server, and the whole assumption is combined they'll be using more resources that the other ones aren't needing at once.
Yeah, and you can do things like, you know, allocate resources. Like this piece should get this much CPU and this one should get this much. And if the computer's not doing anything, it's okay for this other one to take more than the other one. But if this one's paying for this certain ratio and and we're at 100%, this one should get it.
Yeah.
That kind of thing.
Yeah, and again, the benefits are you're distributing the cost. You have, you know, a bunch of small computers on one computer, you're not buying hardware, and it combines to be that, you know, everyone pulling their money together can get, you know, quite a decent machine.
Yep, and the advantage is you can install any software you want. If you want your own version of PHP or Python or, you know.
Mm-hmm. If I want to install gems for Rubies, I can do that. I am the administrator of my machine.
Yep, if you have a problem with your machine and you need to reboot it, you can go ahead and do that because it's mm-hmm. your machine. It doesn't affect everybody else on that. Well, it's your own virtual machine. It doesn't affect anybody else on the physical machine.
Yeah.
So you get all the benefits of the shared except your virtual. So mm-hmm. I guess the disadvantage would be cost.
More expensive. Yeah, exactly. Virtual shared hosting is really cheap because just serving plain websites is really easy.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't take up, you know, you can have a lot of virtual or a lot of domains pointing to one server, and they're relatively unaffected by each other unless something goes wrong.
Right.
With a virtual server, it is more expensive because you can serve less people on one. More than, you know...
Typically, the customers of a virtual private server are going to be doing things that require more CPU, more... You know, because otherwise they would just stick with the shared hosting. Or you'd be doing more custom stuff, so it might take up more resources than, say, shared hosting.
Yeah, or specifically not just basic web port 80 stuff.
Right.
Let's say I wanted to run, you know, a different web server than Apache, you know, Light HTTPD or something like that. Mm-hmm. I could do that with a virtual private server. I can't with shared hosting because they're saying, no, this is your slice. You can do PHP. You can do, here's MySQL, but right. it's running so through Apache because that's what it's set up with.
So if you want your own custom database, you don't want to use MySQL or whatever, the virtual private server is pretty much your only option.
Yeah, maybe I want to serve an internal web app that I want accessible from the internet, but I just don't want it on port 80 so I can run it on port 3000 or something. And mm-hmm. you know, most people won't find that randomly. Mm-hmm. You can do that with a virtual private server. There are two kinds of virtual private server, though. There's sort of the economy virtual private server. This is would be like DreamHost PS. SliceHost is a really popular one. I can't remember the third. There's a couple other out there. But then there's like the big daddy of virtual private mm-hmm. servers.
This is about as good as you can get. Amazon EC2, which Elastic Cloud Computing is what that stands for, is really high-end commercial style. And usually the difference is it's not the machines. I mean, a computer is a computer. The difference there is you're going to be getting the bandwidth that's backing Amazon. I mean, you're going to get the big fat pipes.
Mm-hmm.
With Amazon, you get any OS that you want. You know, SliceHost lets you pick the distribution as well. But for example, you get a virtual machine with 1.7 gigs of memory. You get your own core and 160 gigs of hard drive space.
But it's expensive. SliceHost is more expensive than, you know, regular shared hosting. But this is for people that are really doing something that needs to be needs to have a step up, and it needs to have the ability to expand at the drop of a hat. That's mm-hmm. the benefit of having Amazon is they have all these resources. They're the reason Amazon started doing some of these things was they were coming up with really innovative solutions to run Amazon. Mm-hmm. This is like the storage thing they do.
Simple
S3. S3, yeah. So like Amazon S3, they had to do, you know, they had to store all these pictures and stuff for Amazon and make it really, you know, cloud-like, really distributed. Mm-hmm. And they're like, well, you know, we had to go through all this work to do it for Amazon. Why don't we just sell it to other people and let them do it too?
Yeah, one of the advantages of more of the commercial virtual private server is you can get them hosted all over the United States or planet, where SliceHost is probably, well, not, I shouldn't say SliceHost, but some of the more economy line virtual private servers might be only, you know, in one area, one state even. Mm-hmm. So if you need to distribute your content across international or even the United States, you might want to go for more of the commercial style. It is more expensive though. I figured it out for the cheapest, absolute cheapest, and if you prepay for a year just to keep the machine running, it would cost you about $50 a month. And you're going to be, that's not to mention the bandwidth, which costs 10 cents per gig in and 17 cents out.
Yeah.
That's the cheapest.
Yeah, it's definitely a more commercial solution. So, you know, some of the other ones, like a lot of shared hosting, even I think DreamHost now just has unlimited gigabyte transfer plans. They just mm-hmm. kind of say whatever, you know. When you get into the more commercial stuff, they're making sure that, and this is actually better if you have a business too, because with DreamHost I may be paying for other people's bandwidth that I'm not using. Uh-huh. I mean, this is more business like it's you're paying for exactly what you're using and what you need,
right? And one of the advantages of doing that is you can actually scale. You can add more virtual machines as you need them, because yeah. you're paying by the hour. You're not paying just monthly, month to month. You're literally paying for per hour. So you could say, if we noticed at 5 o'clock on Sundays, we get a huge traffic hit every week. So you add servers right before that, and then you have the variable expanding server resources.
Yeah.
Versus just this is what you got.
Exactly. So it's very scalable. You have the power of a big company like Amazon running it. Like you said, if you need to create a virtual machine, another backup one instantly, Amazon can do that because they have all this big capital behind them to put in that sort of infrastructure to do it.
Yep.
So they can do it and crank it out. You know, with like Slice Host, you're basic, you know, you're kind of buying your computer. And when you need to upgrade it, it's kind of a big deal. Not a huge deal, but you upgrade it. It's kind of a step up.
Go in, upgrade your plan and stuff. Whereas Amazon's got, they actually have an API. You could actually have a script or something that automatically starts adding machines to your cloud.
Yeah. So pretty intense. But so that's when you're starting to get really, really up there.
Another advantage of just virtual private servers, especially the commercial ones, is that you can use them for things other than websites. They're just a computer. They're not like a web hosting. You could run like a game server,
like VoIP stuff like TeamSpeak and I can't remember what the other one, Ventrilo, IRC servers if you want to run IRC.
An FTP server.
Yeah, an FTP server, your own FTP server, your own mail server if you want. But it requires you to administer your computer. That's the other thing. It is a computer and you need to know how to administer it. And if you don't, then you need to hire a system administrator. With shared hosting, I really don't. I have my web space to put up my stuff, and I put it up, and I expect it to work. There's no problems. If I have an issue, I submit a ticket. And so as long as my web stuff is being served, it's okay. With a virtual private server, you need to have people managing it for you because it really is just an empty computer that you need to run yourself.
So let's say that that's not good enough for me. What would the next step be?
The next step is co-location. And what colocation is when you put your own server in a giant data center. You're paying for a unit inside of their rack. You're paying for power. You're paying for cooling. You're paying for network. But other than that, it's your physical server in a data center.
So you want the bandwidth, but you want your own physical server that it's yours.
Yeah, and so this is like, let's say even... I don't know. It's kind of weird because colocation, we say, is a step up. But things like Amazon's flexible cloud computing is very powerful.
Yeah,
at the same time, it's very powerful. It's very scalable. But let's say you have a piece of hardware that is not just a server. Let's say you have some, meeting hardware, what is that company that does it? I can't even think right now. But that does like video conferencing and stuff. It's specialized hardware. It's not just a server running software. It's specialized hardware, but it's rack. You would get a spot at a data center. You would co-locate it and slam it in there.
You're not going to just be adding computers at 5 o'clock on Sunday every other week or, you know, anything weird. Like, it's not going to be a variable. It's going to be, I need five computers, five racks, or I need one or whatever.
Or let's say you already bought the hardware. You've got a $30,000 server sitting in your back room. And someone says, why don't you use Amazon EC2? You're like, well, I've kind of already sunk $30,000 in a computer, so I have to use it somewhere. You throw it in, and this also comes up, allows you to do your own creative solution. Let's say, you know, Amazon Cloud Computing is pretty cool, but let's say you want to do your own sort of scaling solutions using MySQL and other things that you might not be able to do with them. Well, with this, it's like having a server in your front room, except for your front room is a data center with a direct pipe to the internet.
And why you wouldn't do it in your front room is probably because the bandwidth would be too expensive to run just one machine.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, these guys have a huge data center full of machines, so they can get a better price on the bandwidth.
Yeah, and they're running, you know, cooling and stuff like that. So this is, you know, Amazon's EC2 stuff is in a data center co-located somewhere.
Right.
Their own data. They probably don't co-locate. It's probably their own data center. But
so it's probably not fair to say that it's better. It's just different.
Yeah, it is. A lot of people don't want to use... Again, so here's another example. You're dependent upon Amazon. If they decide they don't want to do the EC2 cloud computing tomorrow, you're pretty much SOL. You have your own co-located box. If your data center is going out of business, pop it and stick it in another data center. It's your hardware, and you're in control of it, absolutely control of it. So, the disadvantage to this, of course, is expensive. You have to have your own hardware. Hardware is pretty expensive. You're not sharing really the cost of anything except for heat and internet with other people in the data center. And again, you have to have your own system administrator. This kind of system administrator even costs more because they're managing hardware as well. They're not just managing software. They're not just managing a virtual computer somewhere. They're actually managing the hardware of it and have to go drive to the data center to do anything. Like if your server dies, Again, there's another disadvantage. Your server may die. If you're like using a virtual server, they should be backing it up. If their hardware dies, they move you to another piece of hardware, and you should really not notice much of a disruption of services. With virtual machines now and stuff, you can do all kinds of live migration from different hardware. So, you know, you won't notice that if hardware goes down. If you're co-locating, it's your hardware. It's dead. Hopefully you have an extended warranty. You can get it fixed. If not, you're SOL.
Yeah, and then and like you said, you had the sunk cost of buying the server versus mm-hmm. Amazon. You just, you know, it's a virtual machine. You don't have to worry about mm-hmm. that.
But co-location is really popular. A lot of people think they can do it better and can save money that way too, instead of using a cloud computing service. So,
and it's yours.
Yeah,
you're
yours.
You're not out on the cloud.
Yeah, exactly. You're not out on the cloud. And a lot of people, cloud computing is gaining in popularity. A lot of people don't like to be in the cloud. It's yours. You're in control of it. They want to be able to touch it and feel it and say, hey, this is my physical hardware. I like it. You know, there some people, it's funny, they kind of distrust. They're like, well, Amazon says I have guaranteed CPU, but I don't believe them. You know, in this way, it's like, I have guaranteed CPU because I bought the thing and stuck it in the motherboard. But it is. It's really expensive. It's sort of the end game for anybody who's going all the way.
Okay.
So, and it's pretty expensive. And, you know, I don't know. I mean, I really am a fan of virtual machines. I think as it gains popularity, I think we're going to be seeing a lot more really cool things done with it, because things like upgrading costs are distributed amongst all people on the server. So instead of co-locating your own box and being like, man, my CPU is getting really old, I have to buy a whole new machine, that cost is distributed against everyone as you're just paying for the service of it all.
Yeah, if something goes wrong with it, you just throw it away, put the new one in, and the new virtual machine in, and you're good to go again.
Yeah, it's literally sort of the virtual machining is sort of the pinnacle of distributed costs for everything amongst people. You know, it's a distributed cost of hardware, it's a distributed cost of system administration, it's a distributed cost of all kinds of things. I think it's really cool. Well, that wraps it up for this episode of Face Off. We want to remind you guys that you can subscribe to the show by going to faceoffshow.com/subscribe. You can also leave feedback for the show using various methods by going to faceoffshow.com/feedback. And if you guys get a chance, leave a review for the show on iTunes. That really helps get the word out, and we'd appreciate it. So we'll see you guys next week.